What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation. Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report, the foremost podcast for legal technology news and information. With all the buzz around predictive coding, the focus is on the right-hand side of the EDRM, what can be done to optimize the review and production process with innovative technology. But you know, the left-hand side of the EDRM rarely gets attention these days. But in reality, if the left-hand side of the EDRM processes get ignored, what kind of data do you end up downstream? If you do not start the EDRM process on the best foot from the beginning, you aren't going to get it right in the end. And not even the best predictive coding technology can save you. Here to discuss some of the newest technologies on the left-handed side of the EDRM is Troy Ronning. Troy Ronning is a systems engineer at Kroll On Track, specifically providing subject matter expertise and technical expertise for the OnTrack Power Controls software program. Leveraging over 10 years of experience in the information management software market, he provides first-hand technical and sales support to external software partners and resellers, as well as conducts products demonstrations, installation, and trainings. Well-versed in the recovery of Microsoft Exchange and SharePoint data, Mr. Ronning regularly participates in online discussion forums pertaining to Microsoft Exchange and SharePoint management. Hi, Troy. Thanks for joining me today on the ESI Report. Our listeners will be thrilled to have a techie view of the left-hand side of the EDRM.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So let's go ahead and dig right in, perhaps maybe with a little bit of background. When we say left-hand EDRM, what stages of the process are we really talking about? And why do you think this area is getting less attention today with the buzz around predictive coding and document review?
Well, I think that's a fair question, Michelle. Really, what we're talking about today on that left-hand side is information management, identification, preservation, and ultimately collection. It's not quite as glamorous. It's challenging in general. But it's not as interesting as maybe some of the really cool technologies that go into reviewing your data and doing all the predictive coding and really getting down to the meat of what counts for the matter or the case at hand.
So perhaps we could talk about some of the challenges of the left side of information management and data preservation, data collection. What are some of the largest obstacles that you've seen?
Sure. Well, I think first and foremost, the challenge is as corporations grow and data storage grows, people are losing track of where their data is and where it's stored. Everything's predefined to the end user, but with IT managing, hundreds of terabytes of data throughout the network, they can't really rely on where they think everything is. So when they get the request, for X, Y, or Z, it's really difficult to know exactly where that exists without, a formal interview process. So number one is, where does it actually reside? And then the second part of that is identifying it. Okay, so maybe I know where all my data is, but how do I know where the pertinent data is or where the data is that's accessible by my users? Or even where they're storing it, because I may tell them where to store it, but that doesn't always mean that that's where they are going to store it. And then I think preservation is handled pretty firmly by several products in the industry that do a really good job of that. But the challenge grows when they need to collect the data. I think we have a lot of tools that are getting better on the collection side, But I would say, you know, in the last couple of years, those tools have definitely got better. But prior to that, we didn't really have a lot of tools available for corporations to do this on their own, unless, of course, they had a pretty hefty wallet.
So you have years of experience, Troy, collecting data on behalf of clients that are looking to that are in the middle of some sort of e-discovery matter and have to get this data and get it ready for review. You've gone all over the world doing that. I thought maybe you could give us a little bit of a couple of instances where you have run into problems collecting data on behalf of Kroll OnTrack clients that you've worked for.
That's a loaded question. Really, every project was different, I should say. It was different. And the tool sets we had back then we didn't have many options. So you were stuck with either forensically imaging information and preserving all the active and the non-active slack space on the drive. And that worked fine for the PC level collections. But when it came down to server data, whether it be Exchange or, well, SharePoint wasn't really big back then, Exchange or even database backends, the tools to do those jobs were very limited. So you were relying on native Microsoft practices to develop PSTs. And in some rare instances, those PSTs were larger than 2 gigs, and oftentimes you didn't know that until it was too late. So you had to go back and rerun it and date range the data and get out multiple PSTs so the tool didn't crash. So the reliability of the tools kind of created a lot of the problems and the unpredictability of the data volumes. That was definitely a challenging part. And then you had the whole database-driven tools where you've got all this data sitting in a great repository in the database, but it really is not usable unless you have a front end to take a look at it. So there were challenges in trying to figure out how to render the data in usable fashion. But I think working closely with both the legal representation and the IT representation, getting them to the table and talking about the problems at hand and constructively working out solutions to those problems, I think that's where we had our successes. And we were able to really make sure our customers were always taken care of.
So let's fast forward to today, you know, 10, 13, 14, 15 years later. Talk a little bit about your experiences today and how the software for collection has improved and how those experiences go today when you're out meeting with clients and collecting data for e-discovery.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I'm finding more and more organizations kind of taking control and proactively taking control rather than the reactive world we used to be in. You know, it's no longer okay to sit back and think, oh, we're never going to be in litigation. That's not going to happen to me. People are now anticipating it, and they're ready for it. And the tool sets that are out there in the market, whether it be ours or somebody else's, are much more advanced and affordable. You're not only limited to, you know, the encased enterprises of the world that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to deploy in your corporation. You now have affordable tools that really can take care of those little niche applications and collection procedures. So I think that has evolved, and people are just being more proactive, and they're more engaged, and they're trying to really anticipate the things that are coming downstream. And so they're ready for it.
And organizations are deploying this technology, so they're bringing it in-house, and they're ramping people up and building their expertise in-house so that they can do some of this their own self when it comes to collection.
Yep. I think it comes down to controlling costs and actually having their hands around it too.
So talk a little bit about some of the tools, specifically perhaps the OnTrack Power Controls product that you support. What are some of the benefits of these programs and some of the things that clients are really embracing in using them?
Sure. Well, yeah, I'm a little biased. I do work with the OnTrack Power Controls product. But there's so much great out there as well. What I'm seeing a lot with power controls with the new 7.0 release specifically, it's geared around really attacking that Microsoft Exchange and Microsoft SharePoint data that lives out there. And that happens to be where a lot of the pertinent data is in today's world. Everything's done via email, and there's ways to get it out natively, but it's not as efficient. So now we can work with legacy backup and preserve the metadata throughout the whole process and deliver you pristine, full PSTs, or even, you know, first called PSTs, so you're getting a smaller subset of data that's relevant. So we've got enhanced keyword searching, date ranging, and ways to really narrow it down. So you're not handing over the keys to the kingdom. You're simply giving them the relevant pieces of the kingdom and not giving something you're not supposed to be.
And those technologies, really, it's before early data assessment, it's before review. You're using this technology to do some of that analysis early on, even in the collection phase of the EDRM.
Absolutely. We, there's great early case assessment, early data assessment tools out there. And we're definitely not trying to take place of that. We're just simply trying to find, we're a feeder into those systems, making sure you're getting some pretty good call data in there so you can further define that data.
So before we go, any last minute advice for listeners struggling with information management, preservation, and collection, the left-hand side of the EDRM, any advice for folks trying to bring some order to chaos?
Well, that's a million-dollar question. You're not the only one. Everybody's in the same position you are. You have many choices. So take a look at everything and digest it all. Don't make any snap decisions. And try it before you buy it. Definitely give it a drive around the block and make sure, you know, kick the tires, whatever analogy you'd like to use. But make sure it's going to do the job for you. And, reach out to social media. There's a lot of people that are willing to talk about what works and what doesn't work. And give us a call. We've got some product and, take a look at it.
That's some great advice, Troy, especially that I never would have thought about, turning to Twitter, turning to Facebook to see what other organizations and IT organizations are using when it comes to a collection tool. Great ideas. You know, before we go, I want to pick your brain a little bit more, but this time perhaps we'll have a little bit of fun and lighten things up a little bit. We try to not take ourselves too seriously on the ESI reports. And so if you're game, I'm calling this technology costs then and now. I'll list off an old piece of hardware, which was the peak of its prime back in the day. And I'm hoping you can guess the price of that item when it was released. And if you're game, I will even convert the dollars for you to today's equivalent with inflation.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm afraid we're probably going to find out just how old or young I really am fast.
So we'll start off. We'll go back to 1977, back a couple of decades. This old desktop microcomputer was sold by Radio Shack, and it was quite uncooperative in the office, but it was the TRS-80. Any idea as to what price this Radio Shack computer was back in 1977?
Well, I feel like he just put a blindfold on me and pointed me in the right direction of a dartboard. In 1977, I would have been 2 years old. But I can tell you, I honestly have not ever used or seen this other than in some web pages or something to that effect. I do know Tandy made it. I know they made computers for quite a while. I'm going to guess it was somewhere around 1977, the dollar being what it was. I'm going to say maybe $250, $350. That's good, $350.
You know, you're close, but a little bit low. $600 you would have paid for the TRS-80 by Tandy, and you could have bought it at Radio Shack back in 1977. The equivalent of, so $600 then, the equivalent of about $2,300 today you would be paying for that that piece of beautiful computing power.
It's the size of a Sherman tank, that's for sure.
It would have taken up your whole desk.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's move forward a little bit, perhaps something that's a little bit more relevant to your experience, the 80s. We'll turn to the 80s. We'll get out of the 70s. And 1986, Apple was gaining steam, and the little green-screened Apple IIgs. I remember this computer. This computer, my parents had this computer, and it was outstanding because if you remember, those old displays had the green characters on the screen, which was a step up from the kind of the brown and orange that the TRS-80 had back in the 70s. So the Apple IIgs back in 1986, it was the heyday of what Apple had to offer back then. What was its price upon release? How much did my parents have to pay for that thing?
Well, I think they probably paid a fortune just because of the name Apple, right? So, again, 11 years old at this time. And I can tell you my family didn't own its first computer until probably 89 or 90, and I probably had little exposure, except for I probably used this in school. It was the size of a microwave oven today. I'm going to say it's probably around $1,200.
Pretty close. About $999 in 1986, about $1,000, the equivalent of about $2,100 in today's dollars. So pretty close, about $900, right around $1,000. So we'll fast forward just a little bit more. 1992, the IBM ThinkPad, which was my first work laptop in the early 90s. And I think all of us have had an IBM ThinkPad if you've had in your professional career, if you've been working for a decade or two. Any idea what the budget model was? It was the 300 model of the IBM ThinkPad in 1992. How much would that have cost us?
The budget model, is there such a thing with ThinkPad? Well, the 300, I sure hope yours wasn't the 300. That thing was quite heavy, large, and boxy. Knowing IBM for what they demand for ThinkPad price, I'm going to say that was probably about $1,700.
Really close. $1,900, $1,999. So almost $2,000. For which is about the equivalent of $3,300 today for an IBM ThinkPad in 1992. And they were heavy. They were absolutely heavy. And you had to drag them around. It was crazy. It was crazy when you think about how little and sleek the iPad is today. So just one more before I take up too much of your time. Time to move forward again to talk about Apple's resurgence. If you remember 1998, The iMac G3, these had the rainbow of cool colors, and everyone was talking about what color, if you were going to get the pink one or the blue one or the green one, if you remember those iMacs. And any idea how much people would have paid for those rainbow-colored iMacs about 1998?
Well, I remember the iMac, Michelle, because I wanted one, because it looks so cool being self-sufficient and everything. But the cool thing about it is that it was all self-contained, and that was great until you needed to get the hard drive out. I'm going to say the self-contained unit, I'm going to say about $1,800.
A little bit high. They were about $1,300, $1,299 in 1998, or the equivalent of about $1,800 today. So it shows you not too much inflation there from the late 90s. But yep, about $1,200, $1,300 for an iMac back in right around the turn of the century. And you were right, everybody wanted one back then because they turned the corner on computing and the self-contained everything in one box started at that point. Well, Troy, thank you. That was fun. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Absolutely. Thank you.
It was a blast from the past. And with that, we're ready to wrap up this month's ESI report. Thank you again to Troy Ronning for bringing his expertise and insider knowledge on collection preservation and collection preservation of electronic information in eDiscovery. Troy, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me, Michelle.
Finally, thank you to everyone listening, and thanks to Kroll On Track for sponsoring another edition of the ESI Report with the Legal Talk Network. For more information about all things e-discovery, check out www.theediscoveryblog.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Michelle C.S. Lang. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report, your source for e-discovery news and information.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track. Be sure to follow Kroll On Track on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll On Track software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.